Hello, and I'm Annika Wills, and I played Polly in Doctor Who in 1966, and you are listening to Gallifrey Public Radio.
I'm Adam from the Digital Suit Podcast, a proud member of the Gunna Geek Network, just like the show you're listening to now. The opinions expressed are those of each individual. Check out all the other podcasts at GunnaGeek.com, and get ready, because geekiness begins in 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to positive enjoyment of everything in the Doctor Who spectrum. Join us each week for discussions ranging from Hartnell to Whittaker and beyond. Your GPR hosts are Jay Witten.
Safety measures are for chumps who don't know what they're doing.
Kier Hansen.
Oh, hold on. I saw it on my mixer. I turned up the suck. Hold on.
And Haley Malley.
I feel like I might need to carb up for next week's episode.
Oh, and
spoilers.
We do discuss recent news, episodes that have already aired in their home territories, and the occasional interesting rumor. But don't worry, if we look too far into the future, we'll give you a fair warning. Welcome to episode 289 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where the gold flakes on our Park Avenue $75 ice cream sundaes aren't just pointless displays of opulence. They are a survival tactic, thank you very much. I'm Kier.
I'm Haley.
And I'm Jay, and this week we close out the 12th classic Doctor Who season with the return of the Boys in Silver, Revenge of the Cybermen. Harry and Sarah Jane get their first exposure to an adversary that the Doctor assured them was defeated, and as you would expect after a seven-year absence, there's been a couple upgrades.
Upgrades, downgrades, I think we might need to take this one apart.
Just a little bit.
As we will always do, we're going to take first blush reactions on these. I will admit that this is probably of the entire 12th season, which I love. This, okay, yeah, well, that says everything. I'm not really gushing with words here. This is probably the one that I have seen the least frequently. I'll say that much. So, Haley, I'm pretty sure this is your first watch.
Yep.
Okay. Reactions and responses.
That was an episode. I had a hard time focusing on this episode. I couldn't tell you exactly what it was with only one watch through, but I know I didn't particularly enjoy it.
Okay. All right. Jay, what's your familiarity with this particular story?
I've seen it once, and that was all it took for me.
Okay, and meaning this was the once.
No. I mean, like, I've seen it once before, and there's a reason why this is the first time I've revisited since.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. Well, there's something about this particular story. I mean, before we get into some of the explanation as to why it may not be, you know, this crown jewel, we'll sort of, you know, look at some of the aspects that we can particularly enjoy, because that's what we're shooting for here. Mm-hmm. I would say at this point, after their five stories together, the Fourth Doctor, Sarah Jane, and Harry Sullivan have gelled pretty well as a TARDIS team.
Yeah.
I mean, even Harry, as much as they were trying at times to paint him to be, I don't know, almost a unable to fit, because he kept sort of getting into little discussion issues with Sarah Jane, and the Doctor just seemed to treat him with disdain on such a regular basis. But this time around, I think they've kind of figured out where everybody's strengths and weaknesses are and how to use them to mutual advantage. But again, I think we're running into a lot of issue of separation again. They're getting back into that separation story where the companions are apart from the Doctor and you've got the two concurrent storylines. Did that work? It may have been in your favorite execution, but was it effective as far as keeping the concurrent plots moving at a equal level of interest?
Equal level of interest, possibly. The fact that that level was incredibly low may not have benefited much. There was just an awful lot going on, and none of it was overly interesting.
That's what I was thinking. There were two stories going on, and neither of them had enough meat to it to hold my interest.
Okay. Well, I mean, obviously the basic premise here, we're dealing with the Vogons. The Vogons. Just keep driving that into your head. So the Vogons with
their... Hitchhiker's Guide. That's why Vogon sounded so familiar. I couldn't figure it out. Sorry. Continue with your point.
But the idea of being the sitting on this gold resource, and obviously I do like the allusion, the fact that we get this reference to these cyber wars that we weren't really privy to prior, at least as far as televised, that gold was intrinsic to, and that the fact that if the humans did not have the Vogon gold supply, the Cybermen would have been, you know, would have obviously taken that handily, but. That whole idea of the gold weapon, glitter guns, a whole lot of handfuls of gold dust getting thrown around, that was about, it was not the strongest premise to build a story on. After we've been handed so many great, even from Terry Nation himself, so many great storylines over the course of the season, it just seemed a really unusual one to end the season on, particularly. What were some of the highlights? What were some of the things that you took away from this that were pretty enjoyable?
I like that Harry is the butt of the joke at this point.
Okay. You want to expound on that?
Yeah, I mean, just there's a few moments where the doctor gives him a look or, you know, calls him out on how he's maybe not making the wisest of decisions at times.
Yeah. Again, it's knowing the strengths and weaknesses. I think the doctor could have been a lot more acidic to him, mm-hmm. and probably had, you know, would have been two or three adventures ago. At this point, he can shut him down with that glance. He's also getting comfortable enough with the two of them that he's cracking out the dad jokes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I hope I don't lose my arm here. I'm rather attached to it. It's rather handy. Maybe you don't want to leave Jerry Davis all of the really cracking humor when he's writing a script like this. Might not be his strong suit, but thankfully, I mean, you're putting in Baker's hands, so at least he can make it charming.
Right.
The as far as the idea of reusing the whole idea of the, well, obviously coming back to the Nerva beacon, you know, and the idea of missing their target on their transmat back by backing up some thousand years or so earlier than they were expected. How did that convention strike you as saying, all right, well, we're going to reuse some sets. We're going to tweak the storyline a little bit, but we're going to bring the Cybermen into it and somehow close out this this Nerva space station arc by kind of flipping the whole... flipping the story into another adversary, but keeping us local so that by the time the TARDIS arrives in the final seconds, oh, there you've been this entire time.
Refresh my memory. Which story was it that took place on this before?
Ark in Space.
Okay.
Yeah, I would have liked it had there didn't seem to be any point in coming back to the space station aside from budgetary constraints. Like, let's reuse the set so we don't have to build a new one. Had it paid off at the end with, like, they were about to leave and Harry accidentally opened the window and let in a bug or something like that. Like, yeah, had it done something to set up the beginning of the arc, that would have been interesting. That would have been like, oh, well, it makes sense that they came back to it now.
Well, I think the closest thing you got was obviously Sarah Jane watching the newsreels about the flares. And that sort of that knowing look on her face, she said, okay, so this is where a lot of it starts to emerge. And then we caught the tail end of it after the Great Exodus. I thought that was an interesting segment to leave in. And it just shows the cognizance of wanting to bring this whole thing full circle. I would have expected it to be a little bit more connected, other than just reusing the location. But at least that was something that showed that there was some
thought about it. Yeah.
Presence of mind.
Yeah.
Apparently, I'm still kind of wrapping my head around the changes that they chose to make after 7 years absence with the Cybermen and bringing them back in this new format. I love the suit upgrade. Absolutely love it.
Mm-hmm.
Love the fact that there's a little bit of a rank system now. You know, you've got your cyber leader and things, because now as a result of these wars, they were just, it seemed like they were just sort of these automatons when we were previously dealing with them. But now they have purpose, they have rank, they have structure. There's only three of them, but whatever. Maybe the suits are expensive to build. And there's a weapons upgrade. Head cannons.
Yes.
Literally. Mm-hmm. Before I get to my one downside, and there is only really, really one, what was your take on our cyber upgrades? Cybermen, Cybermat, everything that's gone through a bit of a change.
I thought they all looked good. I don't think I ever remember hearing a Cyberman talk as much as the Cyber Leader did.
Yeah, that's true. I agree. I think they looked good. It's a heck of a lot better than the ski mask with duct tape around the mouth. But it was kind of like... It didn't feel like Cybermen just because of that, because the Cyber Leader was very verbose, and it almost seemed like they wanted to use a different character or something, or I don't know, just...
Okay, yeah. Almost as if they had just decided at some point to use the Cybermen in this. Maybe the story had potentially been written with something else in mind, but I'm not sure if that would have held. But yeah, the verbosity of the Cyber Leader, but also the intonation... Very expressive, almost, there are times when there's inflections of the voice that felt emotional, and exactly. That's not right.
Like towards the end when he's grabbing the doctor and like shaking him, and you can tell he's frustrated, and I'm like, that's not, no.
Right. Yeah. And I think there might have even been things in the dialogue. I'm trying to remember some of the instances. Yeah, towards those closing moments where he's referring to the where he's basically having it out with the doctor and using terms like, and that's good, you know, it's not cyber speak. It's not what we've become accustomed to.
I almost wonder if they had planned at some point to have a non-Cyberman leading this Cyberman party. And then simplified part of the story later?
Yeah. Not really sure. Well, we could definitely find out. I'm sure there's some resources out there for that conversation. I do know. I mean, there were a lot of aspects of this particular story that I thought. I know back on first viewing, the main thing that really kind of threw me off was, and this happened within the first couple minutes. Because of the way that I started, you know, as I got exposed to Classic Who, I was watching it as most American kids did, you know, catching disparate stories here and there. And sometimes it was Tom Baker on Sundays on PBS, and some days all of a sudden it would jump continuity and we'd be Peter Davison and back and forth. But this one didn't really come around that often as far as my opportunity to catch it in rotation as a kid. But by the time I started recognizing the Seal of Rassilon,
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah. So that left a lot of things curious in my head. And I know that they've actually tried to clean it up in canon. I mean, it was just a reuse of a prop. That was long and the short of it. The practical aspect was just the reuse of the prop, both in the costumes and on the wall and tabletop and everywhere else where it showed up, because it was a cool freaking design.
Yeah.
But they did I want to say it was the 90s. Yeah, it was one of the new Doctor Who adventures from the early 90s, the Virgin New Adventures, called Cat's Cradle, the Time Crucible, or Time's Crucible. It was a Mark Platt story. He put in the premise that of all of these cultures the Time Lords have visited sometime along their past, they've left relics. And impressions upon them that have worked their way into the culture. It's the whole idea, you know, the aliens that visited the Egyptians, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So that might explain the prop reuse. I thought that was a rather clean way of tying it all in. Like, yeah, all right, I got it, sure. And big collars.
Temporal big litter collars. Bugs, got it.
As far as the... I will give props... As far as villains go, not to Voris or any of those, and Cybermen being what they are, and all Cyber Leader, as far as just being intimidating in position, might not have been delivered quite the same. But Kelman, I like this guy. I like him from his horrible haircut down to his little oily ways. I thought that was a great performance and a great addition to the story, as far as just having this double crosser who gets double crossed throughout, and he ends up, as so often the trope goes, that in his desire to protect his own neck, ends up with nobody protecting him, because he's basically screwed everybody around him, and they all consider him worthless. That reminds me. Bit of a sticking point. I wanted to get your reactions on this. When Harry causes the bit of the rock slide and Kelman ends up getting crushed, Harry jumps through, checks on Kelman, clearly dead, and so forth. Mm-hmm. Actually gives him a moment of quiet, you know, closes his eyes, which was surprising for him. It just says a lot for Harry. But then Harry goes over and checks on the doctor, realizes he's, you know, he knocked unconscious, he's going to be all right. When the doctor comes around, the doctor, knowing that Kelman's been crushed, did it strike you as a little unusual that he started cackling, laughing like that?
Yeah, a little bit. I didn't really think it so much as, I don't know, that whole thing just seemed kind of weird. Like him waking up and it all felt a little off. But yeah.
To be fair, being almost crushed by rocks is a little disorienting.
I was going to say, I mean, he got bonked in the head. Who knows what that does to Gallifreyan physiology.
That's true. At the final scenes, I thought they would have been a little more careful with the props. As the foam rocks are falling on him, I mean, some of them, on that last shot from above, as they're coming down on his rib cage.
Yeah.
A little bouncy.
Yeah, a little bouncy. I would have expected at least a oof.
Right?
But yeah. But yeah. So I don't know. I liked Kelman as this slimy little dirtbag.
He was easy to hate.
Always that self serving with all of his drawer full of really crappy Bond gadgets, the hairbrush communicator and such. It's like Get Smart gone wrong. But I guess we could say, as far as rewatchability and recommendability, it's unfortunate, but I think I know everybody's take on this. We'll go around the horn just for the sake of closure, but Haley, I know you probably wouldn't recommend it, but would you rewatch it if you caught it on? I mean, if Classic Who was just airing as
just
it does.
Just on TV, for all the times I just sit down to watch syndicated television.
Yeah.
I could see myself rewatching it, like if I were doing, you know, a Cyberman watch or something like that. But if I'm just going to sit down and watch an episode, this is not going to be the one.
Okay.
So.
All right. And so then recommendability to someone only if they're a completionist.
Yeah. Like if you're doing like watching all the episodes like we do, then there's no particular reason to skip this one other than it's just not very good. And I could definitely see someone putting this in their Cyberman pack as they go through.
Sure.
So that those would be the cases in which I recommend it, but not really.
Gotcha. Okay. Jay?
I struggled watching it this time. I really did. Like I was on my phone through the vast majority of it. I can't see myself sitting down and voluntarily watching this without purpose.
Mm. Okay.
As
one other little tiny thing, and it is just tiny thing, is I will say that in this particular story, one of the high points would probably be the incidental music, because at times it really knew when to back off and when to be present. So because we had so many changes of location, you know, we were on the beacon, we were in the caves, we were, you know, within the Vogan in their control rooms and such, and particularly when we were strapped into these sweet backpacks, cyber bombs. I swear that I'm calling it now. I am making a series of actual practical backpacks that look like cyber bombs because I freaking love these things. But that beating pulse that would go through as they were always strapped into them, and at times you really couldn't tell, is that supposed to be the practical sound of this thing that they're wearing, or is it part of the background music? And it was just, I think it was done with a very deft hand. So that aspect, I think, was a real positive. But rewatchability, if I catch it, I catch it. You know, if it's it's there. I do tend to watch in a pretty linear fashion. So when I go through season 12 again, yep, I know I'll watch it again. But recommendability?
You know, the one thing, just for if I'm trying to get somebody like Haley through this, then yeah, I'll send that.
If I'm trying to get somebody like Haley through this. I love that phrasing.
But if it's somebody that is like, really focused on the minutiae, somebody that really likes the little details and stuff like that. This is the introduction of gold as a weapon against the Cybermen that we see come up again. So, I mean, for that aspect, if it's somebody that really likes that kind of thing, right. Yeah, it might be worth tossing them that way. But again, this is one of those things where you really need to know your audience, and this is a very, very small niche that needs to be filled. So
yeah. You could very quickly just dance past and say, by the way, you don't need to watch the story, but just know that if you ever wondered where the gold reference comes from when it comes around back again, it was back in Revenge of the Cybermen. You can watch it if you choose. It's got some great moments with Harry.
Yeah.
I have a quick question. Did they go to some real caves for this episode?
What's that?
Were they in some real caves for this episode?
Yeah. They shot it down in these caves that apparently were haunted. Or were believed to be haunted, and it's sort of, you know how there are instances where if you tell yourself something is true, or you say, oh, this is a bad luck day, then you're going to be looking for all those things to attribute and say, yep, that happened because it was a bad luck day. The whole premise behind filming at this in these particular caves, the Wookiee Hole caves, yes, it's Wookiee, but I'm still going to call it Wookiee. The Wookiee Hole caves was supposed to be bad luck or haunted or whatever. So there were instances like Terry Walsh, the stuntman who does so much, ended up getting injured trying to get Liz Sladen's motorboat, because they had to boat out to this location. He got injured trying to get her out of the water. And then there was an electrician on the set who broke his leg working on getting the lighting rigs throughout the caves. So, looked good, just wasn't really easy on the cast and crew. But hey, no broken collarbones.
We'll get into that.
There's a little point on that in the news tonight, but yeah.
Right.
So yeah, okay, there you have it. I would say, yeah, if you're a completionist, if you really need to know the evolutionary cycle of the Cybermen, if you're just a huge Sarah Jane buff, which I'm not going to begrudge you to watch this one because, you know, she's got some great material in here. If Baker is your doctor, by all means, or if you just need to make sure that you've got the continuity through line for some of the things that, obviously, if you really like Dark and Space and you start following through some of the Series 12, the whole Nerva arc that they've got going, you need this to complete the set because you need to know how they get back. So, or at least how they get their TARDIS back. Because I love that little bit at the end where the space-time telegraph that the Doctor left with the brig that's going to get him, that's going to send messages. I think one of the issues that we had with this in general, and the reason why it felt so anticlimactic, especially to end the season on, is because it wasn't intended to be the end of the season.
Okay.
I mean, the story that follows, that where they open up season 13, Terror of the Zygons, was supposed to be the capper. And when you see it, Haley, spoilers, it's going to feel like it's got that magnitude. But why they made the call the way they did, circumstances being what they are, I don't have all the details on it. Maybe some of our very adept listeners who end up calling me out on a lot of my missing facts can fill me in on these details. But yeah, as the moment I learned that, I thought, okay, that's it. This wasn't intended to be a season stopper. So
it didn't feel like it.
Nah, not even close. So, but Jay, what do we do?
We're doing news.
Let's do news. I did mention that there was some allusion to the collarbone, you know, because we always talk, you know, human physiognomy. Remember how when we were watching the Centauran experiment and we were talking about the fact that Baker had suffered an injury on the set that they deftly hid through, you know, strategic use of draping scarf and coat and things and using body doubles from time to time. Apparently it was a lot more serious to some people, including Tom Baker, than we thought, or that we might have been privy to. Thought he was going to lose his job.
Yeah. So he was actually really worried that this was going to be the end of it, that they were going to say, oh, well, you know, it's a serious injury, and, you know, we can't have somebody getting hurt like that. So he seriously thought that he might have been fired in his like second story.
Mm. It's I have to wonder to a certain degree. Well, first of all, obviously, just the tragedy that would have been if we only had a single season.
Oh, jeez.
Of Tom Baker.
Yeah.
Oh my God. I don't really know what would have happened to the program.
Would there be an American audience for this show if that were the case?
You know what? I know it's a hypothetical, but I would say no. I mean, just think of the longevity that he had in his tenure as the Doctor, and the fact that because there was that bed of material, and it had such a great following that when it was presented for the opportunity for an American network, PBS notwithstanding, I mean, to be able to air it, that was the one of the determining factors. I mean, you've got something that has that much charisma, and if you didn't have a Peter Davison waiting in the wings, you know, and they had to scramble to recast, who in 1975? And now I'm going to go have to scour to figure out who the contemporaries were at the time to figure who could they possibly have handed the role to in 1975 if it wasn't Tom Baker.
Well, I mean, you've only got like what back in the 70s, you had they were up to like 20 actors at that point in England.
Yeah.
So it's a quick, you know, quick jump through.
And two of them were the same guy in a wig.
Exactly.
But no, I mean, that would have been all right. So you got that aspect of it, you know, what would have happened to the program. But then there's also just the whole idea, and I got to be curious about this. Maybe this is just kind of the way the things were different at the time. But if you were to sustain an injury and lose your job, I know talent, you know, when we're talking about, you know, protecting your job, workers' comp, and these are all kind of these American concepts that we've kind of grown accustomed to. But that whole idea of would you lose your role outright because you were considered to be an injury liability? Is it
in the 70s? They could kind of do what they wanted.
Yeah, I guess it was just, you know, as they discussed it, you know, they said that he was in a lot of pain. He was concerned about his job because was he going to be able to carry on as the Doctor? So maybe it wasn't thinking. Well, yeah, I guess they would have had to find a way to be able to close the contract. With compensation, I'm sure it would have been handled in ways that were, well, through all the proper legal channels. But man, what a blow it would have been to the show. Talking about hypotheticals, that brings us to our other point for tonight. And that's that if the opportunity allowed, I know we spoke, was it about 2 or 3 weeks ago? No, it might have been a little bit longer. That we were discussing Jenny, the half-time lord, you know, and Georgia Moffat and some of her work that has now released with Big Finish. I guess because it's back in the public eye, they asked her, as they've been asking everybody, you know, thoughts on Jodie Whittaker, 13th Doctor, come this autumn, which may or may not mean October, on. And would she want to work with Jodie? What do you think the answer would be? I've got to wonder. I mean, well, first of all, how do you think they could possibly, and I know we talked about this back a bunch of times, how would they gracefully reintroduce Jenny? How could you see it playing out?
Oh, geez. The Doctor shows up on a planet, you know, gets an alert on the psychic paper or something like that, shows up on the planet, and here comes this random galactic vigilante type that shows up, and, you know, finally meeting this person, the Doctor goes, Jenny? And Jenny turns around looking at Jodie Whittaker, and I pray to God that she looks at her and goes, Dad?
That's exactly what I wanted her to say, too.
Oh, that would be perfect. It has to be done real close, so it can be that real look deep into the eyes, see the person behind.
Yeah.
Yeah, that'd be extremely cool.
And some confused, gawking companions.
Yes.
Yes, absolutely. No, this would have to happen with absolutely no explanation for the companion. For some time.
Yeah.
Yes, maybe they never get a full explanation. Although, well, here's the thing.
No, you have to explain it because the companions are the new audience.
Yeah,
so.
I was just about to complete that thought. So, you know, some of the audience is going to need the assist. So,
Well, yeah, you could explain it relative. I mean, like, have that moment. That would be the cold open. Then you'd go into the titles, and then you explain it to the companions after the fact. But this would have to be something that was done, like, completely radio silent. Like, you cannot let spoilers of this come out.
Oh, this would get out.
I know.
It's like keeping
a
secret that one of the old doctors is going to have a cameo appearance or something. You can't lock that down.
Depends on the location. Yeah. I really think a lot of it depends on the location. I mean, as we've been seeing from a lot of the stuff that comes from the Doctor Who set reports and such, it always seems that when they've got the nice remote shots, you know, when they're doing the things out in Spain because they need the, you know, the desert settings and that sort of thing, they've done a lot better job keeping things under wraps. And I'm trying to remember exactly where they're doing a lot of the principal shooting, where they were bringing in Sim for hiding his character. Or did they do his makeup remotely and bring him in so that he was unrecognizable by the time he got to the set? I'll have to look back and see. But yeah, they would have to be that kind of caliber of secret. But that would be a nice... because it's not like a... It's not on the same scale as having a classic Doctor cameo. It's a little more nuanced than that. Mm-hmm. So I have a feeling that maybe it wouldn't get quite as scrutinized if she were...
You might be able to keep it under wraps during production and everything, but I think that her reveal ends up in the trailer. Like, so you don't get the shock as the audience is watching.
That's the problem you run into, is that the people that make the next time trailers don't understand this is going to be great if we wait a week.
But again, it gives us more things to play around with, some hypotheticals, because there's no indication, obviously, and you can see from the article that we'll share with you that it's actually going forward with anything. It's really just a matter of, wouldn't you love to? And she says, absolutely, who wouldn't? And I wish Jodie the best, as everyone does, with the exception of a handful of people like Ian Levine. But he's not really a factor in anything, because he's irrelevant. Sorry, all right. Bit of a soapbox.
So next week, we know we've been hyping it for months now, but this time we swear.
Can't wait for this.
Oh, God, the build-up is going to make this so absolutely terrible.
I hope the audio is unusable or something, just so that they never get it. The file has been corrupted in the time you've been waiting for this.
Shut up. I'm the only one sitting on that file right now. That can't happen. So
next week,
cursed episode that will never be aired. We'll keep promising. Well, actually, this is working out really well, because every time we say that we're going to release our audio from the Broadchurch in Space panel at Regen, something
happens. We actually
happens,
get a really
like,
awesome
later,
interview.
And we end up with this great interview. So we say we're going to release it, and then
I'm not saying we're talking to Jodie Whittaker next week, but who knows what's going to happen?
Oh God!
You never really know what's going to happen when my phone rings. You know, the Twitter alert goes off at 3 a.m. because, you know, what time it is elsewhere. And you know, these things have ways of working themselves out. But no, as far as we know.
Short of one of us bumping into David Tennant at the grocery store.
Who knew? I love Greek yogurt. He loves Greek yogurt.
They're just like us.
We will be covering the panel from Regeneration Who, the Broadchurch in Space. So
sure we will.
That's the plan. But
you'll love it.
But, with or without David Tennant sitting in to discuss it with us.
Yeah. But this week, this has been episode 289 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, did you make the rocks fall, Harry?
And this is Kier using the same excuse that I used for most of my sick days at work last year. I'm not lying. I had the plague.
And this is Haley saying, Harry Sullivan is an imbecile.
We'll see you guys next week.
Allons-y.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com, tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, or on Facebook @facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows at 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1GPR. You should also go to GunnaGeek.com and check out lots of other high-quality geek-centric shows, or visit forums.GunnaGeek.com to talk about anything geeky with us or the community.